Knife Man! Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. I'm Ben.
How am I supposed to say my name when it's not nearly as cool as Knife Man?
I mean, it's his name.
I know, but
his real name is probably something like Giovanni.
Yeah, it's probably true. I'm Noel, the ordinary Brown.
We are joined with our guest super producer. Give him a big hand. He's got his own sound cue, super producer Paul Deccant. No Love Lost with super producer Casey Pegram, who will return to his regular American life.
Wait, No Love Lost? You mean they're bitter enemies? Isn't that what No Love Lost means?
You know, I'm using it in this case to say that we don't love Casey any less.
Oh.
We have not lost love for him.
I think that's how it always occurred to me, as it should be said, but I've always understood it to mean some kind of enmity towards a foe.
Like there's no love lost between them.
Exactly.
Well, let's
There was never any to begin with.
Right. Well, let's take it back. Let's make it something positive. The way the Ghostbusters charged that goo in Ghostbusters 2 and made it a positive thing. Do you remember that?
That's a science joke, Ben.
Is that a science
joke? They charged it? You mean like they charged it? Like because it's an ion or something, right? Isn't that an ionic thing?
They positively charged it, yeah. Well, as you can tell from our intro, it's Friday. It's been a long week.
And today's episode is about Ghostbusters. No?
It touches on something spooky.
Yeah.
There's that.
We are still in the throes of Halloween month.
Yes, yes. The most hallowed of weens.
And weirdly enough, the band Ween is doing a double engagement at our famous Tabernacle Theater tonight and tomorrow night.
Oh.
So it's all come full Ween.
It's all happening. It's all happening. Well,
you like Ween?
Yeah, I like Ween. Yeah. I would say I'm a Ween fan.
Me too.
Today's episode, as that's our slow, circuitous route toward today's episode. Today's episode does not, as far as we know, involve the band Ween, but it does involve something grim, grisly, and we'll say it, badass.
Mm-hmm. It does strike me as the kind of thing that Ween might write a song about, because they're all about weird stuff and badass stuff and like kind of psychedelic, trippy stuff. And I feel like this falls into all of those categories.
It does. And it takes us to our story begins long, long ago. But let's start in the middle of the story in 1980s Italy, in a region of northern Italy called Veneto. In 1985, archaeologists made a fascinating discovery. They found a necropolis that housed the corpses of people known as the Longobards.
The Longobards. Also, it took me a minute to realize these were one and the same, known as the Lombards or the Longbeards.
Yes.
It kind of mutated over time because these warring Germanic tribesmen who held sway over a lot of Europe for a lot longer than you would expect, which is, I know, very vague. Maybe, Ben, you can plug in some specific numbers in a minute. But they wore quite long beards.
Yes, and they were nothing to sneeze at. These Germanic people, according to Lombard historian Paul the Deacon, they descended from a small tribe that dwelt in southern Scandinavia, a tribe called the Winili, W-I-N-N-I-L-I. And from this relatively humble beginning, they would rise to eventually rule most of the Italian peninsula from 568 AD to the late 770s, like 774, 75 AD. And that this is the environment in which our story takes place. Noel, as you said, they were known for being warlike.
Ben, did you hear that story that Paul the Deacon wrote about how the Longbeards, a nice apocryphal tale of how the Longbeards may have had some divine intervention in getting that name?
Oh, it's great. Yeah.
It's super cool. So if you've played the new God of War game, I guess it's not that new anymore, but apparently if you get the update, it lets you like replay the entire game using all of your armor, or it lets you like start over again. Just FYI, really cool game, beautiful game. But features Odin and Freya and a lot of this pantheon of Norse gods that these folks worship. I'll tell you who else worshiped them. Was the Winili's kind of rivals, who were the Vandals. And they were in a conflict together because the Winili's refused to pay tribute to the leaders of the Vandals.
And I have a great quote here. The Winili were a smaller tribe, too,
right,
in terms
right.
of numbers.
Yeah, the Vandals had them outnumbered and out-knived or whatever.
Right. which is a nice bit of foreshadowing there. So the Winili said, it is better to maintain liberty by arms than to stain it by the payment of tribute. They thought it would be shameful to pay these people off.
Yeah.
And they said, you know what? If we go down, we're going to go down swinging, and we're going to ask our god for help, Godin, who we know as Odin today.
Oh, Godin.
G-O-D-A-N.
I never heard it said that way before. That's interesting. So yeah, so the Vandals and the Winili both appealed to Odin and said, hey, we would like it very much if you would grant us a victory, to which Odin replied he would give a victory to the tribe he first saw at sunrise. Mm-hmm. And then apparently the mother of the two Winili leaders, whose names were Ibor and Io, mm-hmm. went to Freya, who was Odin's wife.
The mother's Gambara.
Exactly, yeah, Gambara. And Freya told Gambara that the women of the tribe should take their hair and tie it in front of their faces so they looked like beards and then appear at sunrise.
So that they seem to have more numbers than they do, more soldiers at least. And then Freya also, according to this story, loads the dice a little bit because she turns Odin's bed to face east at sunrise, and she wakes him. And because of this, Odin sees the Winili tribe first and said, who are these longbeards?
And then according to this article from abouthistory.com, Freya responded, well, since you've given their tribe a name, you should also give them a victory. And that he did. Mm-hmm. You know, if you'd like to believe this legend.
I like to believe this one. It's an inspiring story. We should also note that Paul the Deacon wrote his history of the Longbeards, the Historia Longobardorum, mm-hmm. which is fun to say.
Of course.
He wrote this between late 780 AD, so 787, 788, and 796. So he wrote this far, far after the events had transpired.
That's right. And I just want to back up what you said a minute ago, Ben. These women with the beards tied in front of their faces were added to the ranks of the men who already sported these long, bushy beards right. that they did not want to cut. So it would make them appear to have greater numbers. And I don't know. I don't know what Freya's logic was here. I can't get inside the head of a god.
It's to be more intimidating. And also, I love the moments in mythology and folklore where someone plays a trick, where cleverness becomes as important as physical strength, like turning the bed east.
Yeah, but it's also like there's a lot of what one might consider cheating in some of these stories.
Oh, sure.
You know, or like being dishonest. But sometimes that's just having gumption, tenacity. And, you know, like you said, loading the dice a little bit yeah. in a clever way.
And that's all that, you know, that's classic Longobard. So these, or Longbeards, if you prefer, that might be more fun for some of us. So this is how the tribe started. And they expanded, possibly with the help of divine intervention. And as we said, they go on to, for a not insignificant amount of time, rule a large swath of Italy. And in 1985, we're going to jump around in time a little bit here for the sake of the story. In 1985, archaeologists discover a necropolis for the Longobard people that has over 200 corpses buried inside, 222. And in these different areas of the necropolis, they find some strange, weird things. They found one female corpse with two brooches that were used to estimate the time, roughly, when these people were interred. They also found two greyhounds and a horse, but they did not find the head of the horse.
Yeah, it wasn't a headless horseman. It was a headless horse.
Mm-hmm.
Still quite appropriate for Halloween times.
And that's just the beginning, because as we learned in the paper entitled Survival to Amputation in Pre-Antibiotic Era, a case study from a Longobard necropolis, courtesy of Journal of Anthropological Sciences, this necropolis contained one corpse that was extraordinary.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
Yes, in many ways. They found a man who was between 40 and 50 years old. They say they pegged it at 47 in the paper. And his body, even hundreds of years later, showed signs of extreme hardship. And
that is putting it very diplomatically, Ben. Yeah,
signs of extreme hardship and privation. His teeth were all kinds of messed up. The enamel was extremely worn down to the point where it was damaging his jaw. He had evidence of plenty of fighting. But most importantly for this story, archaeologists focused on something that he did not have, which was part of his right arm.
Not only was he missing an arm, he was missing an arm in a very unusual way, in that the bone, the nub of the bone where the arm had been amputated, was worn down and calloused in a very particular way that was caused by something else they found in this grave.
That's right. They literally buried the lead long enough. Let's just let it out in the open. This guy had replaced his arm with a prosthetic blade. He had a knife hand.
A knife hand, yeah. And the way it was attached was with like a kind of a cup mm-hmm. that would attach over the nub, and then the blade was fashioned onto the cup. I guess it was like a leather cup of some kind. Mm-hmm. And then there were straps, harnesses, that would fasten it on. And you remember you mentioned a minute ago, Ben, that he had some significant wear and tear to his teeth. One of the ideas is that it was because he was constantly using his teeth to tighten the straps on the knife arm.
Yeah, as he was going through and dealing ungodly amounts of damage to his enemies. You can, in the paper, see close-up photographs of the fellow's teeth. We don't know a ton of details about this man. His name is lost to history. We don't know necessarily what he did in his free time, what his dreams were, what did he have children and so on. But we do know a ton of things based entirely on the state of his body. We know, for instance, that the orientation of his amputated forearm, the orientation of the fracture that occurred, indicates that it was an angled cut by a single blow, probably from a blunt instrument. And this amputation was the result of one of three things: an amputation through injury in combat, which has its own fascinating rabbit hole to follow, a medical intervention, maybe he had a wound and it got infected.
Or some sort of judicial punishment,
right,
is how they put it in the paper, I believe.
Yes, exactly. So he either got in a beef, got sick, or or broke the law.
I'm no, you know, forensics guy or anything, but it does seem like the cleanness of the cut would indicate that he was, you know, had it positioned in such a way to receive the blow, right? Like right. On some sort of like hard surface, or maybe held down, or, you know, something. It doesn't seem like it would be that clean if he just got a giant axe swung at him in battle and got the arm lobbed off.
Right. And there's an interesting thing I've been reading about for something unrelated to this show that ties in very well. And it's the problem of fighting on a battlefield in these ancient days. You know, we see all these depictions in fiction and in historical accounts of groups of people just yelling and running at each other until they collide in blood, sweat, and violence. But is it possible? This is the question I was looking at. Is it possible that some people just faked their death? It just like laid down and waited for the fighting to stop? The answer is yes. And that's why soldiers from either side would go through after a conflict to make sure the dead were dead.
You've seen that in movies. They just go around just stabbing the piles of bodies, mm-hmm. you know?
And in some cases, it was considered an act of mercy rather than an act of malevolence. Because think about it. This is a time with no antibiotics. This is a time where medicine is often administrated through a spiritual leader, right, rather than some sort of doctor. And additionally, this is the biggest point for the idea that this guy may have been injured in battle. Additionally, every time that someone is attempting to recover from an injury, especially one of this magnitude, that means that a community of other people has to take care of them.
Wait a minute. So you're saying the takeaway from this weird knife-armed dude is that, like, people in his lifetime were nice?
to him at least, because he also, the analysis of his teeth, the strontium levels in his teeth, proved that he was not from this area. He was a stranger in a strange land at the time.
And don't you think that 40 or 50 years old is a pretty decent lifetime in this day and age?
And as you said, from the callus, from the calluses and the wear on the amputated limb, we know that this happened a long time before he died. He lived this way for years.
Yeah, and I don't think we can stress enough how important it is to think about the idea that they'd had no antibiotics and no real way to intervene and stop the blood flow other than just to, like, rub it with some sort of poultice or, like, you know, physically bind it and keep an eye on the guy and make sure that he stayed clean. Otherwise, he would have just gone septic and kicked it in no time.
Yeah, absolutely. In the paper, they say, quote, "The Longobard male survived the loss of a forearm even though antibiotics were not readily available. This highlights a community-level effort to provide an ideal setting for healing to take place. This suggests a clean environment with intensive care during the early stages of healing with the ability to prevent death from blood loss, and specific herbal balms were available to the Longobard people for this purpose." And they go back and forth arguing the different cases that this could have been combat and then he was saved by his community, or that it was a judicial punishment where they said, okay, maybe you have stolen something, so now you lose your hand, but we don't want to kill you.
But if that was the case, why would they go out of their way to, like, keep him from bleeding out?
That's the mystery, right?
Right.
And I am tempted to place this injury in the realm of combat or traumatic accident, because as we mentioned, the Longobards invaded in 568 AD, right? And that's when they began to take over Italy. And it looks like this death, this guy was interred in this necropolis not too long after. So he was definitely alive and kicking, and maybe even had both of his hands during the invasion. It's quite possible that they took care of him because he was helping with this takeover, with this regional takeover. By the way, if you're wondering why the Wanili became the Longobards and moved down south like this, the current best guess is it was to seek better resources because they had overpopulated their native land.
And lest we paint a picture of these Lombards as being entirely, like, barbaric or some kind of, like, completely unhinged, warring, you know, psychotic Hun-like force. I mean, they eventually, when they kind of settled, they built a bunch of incredible architecture. They became dukes and had a very very robust system of government and created these territories called duchies. And that's a term that was used moving forward, I believe, Ben.
That is true, Noel. The term duchy did stick around. The Kingdom of the Lombards, also known as the Kingdom of Italy at the time, was established, as we said, in the later part of the 6th century, and they knew that this kind of game was going by King of the Hill rules, not the cartoon, but the actual game. What I mean is they knew that there would be people trying to oust them from their new kingdom. One of the groups that vehemently opposed them was the Byzantine Empire.
Yeah, you had them, you had the Celts, the Celts, Celts?
Celts.
The Celts, there we go. The Celts, that's the worst one. Then you had the Visigoths, or as I like to refer to them as just the Goths, you know? And then you had the Franks.
And they were the big bads. They were the ultimate bosses.
Who, the Franks?
They're the ones who conquered the kingdom, right?
That's true. And yeah, the Franks, Ben, I don't know if you've heard of this little guy named Charlemagne, the Great. You don't get the name the Great unless you're pretty badass.
I'm skeptical of hype.
That's fair. But he was like the big boss. Like you said, he was the big bad. And he is the dude that ultimately led to the downfall of the Longbeards.
Yeah, he even, after the Franks conquered most of the kingdom, he even adopted the title King of the Lombards. And the one city they never managed to gain control of was Benevento, the most southern of the Lombard duchies. So at the time, At the time that this entire empire rose and finally fell, the kingdom of the Lombards was the last holdout, the last minor Germanic kingdom in Europe other than the Frankish Empire. And we should mention, too, there's a good question of how Lombard these people were, or at least their rulers, by the time they fell, because over the more than 100 years that they governed this area of the world, they gradually assimilated to Roman culture. They would get Roman titles. They would start naming their kids Roman names. They would start practicing Roman traditions. So at what level did their assimilation just make them Romans who historically were Lombards? You know what I mean?
Exactly.
But no one was at that level of PC at this time.
Of course not.
They were like, die, long beards. And they almost got our guy, Knife Man.
He would have been a beast on the battlefield.
Can you imagine? There's some great details in here about, well, they still are speculating about how his injury occurred, but there are some great details about his life after the injury. As we said, the teeth on the side of his mouth that he used to tighten the strap were terrible. We cannot overemphasize this. They were terribly worn down, like the pulp was out mm-hmm. of his teeth. Someone had to extract some of his teeth so he could eat.
Yeah, I think he actually like had some sort of serious infection because he ruptured the pulp sac, which is a thing apparently in one of his teeth, and that could have been fatal.
Mm-hmm.
This guy really dodged some serious bullets.
Yeah, he won a brutal lottery for sure. We also know that he didn't. Okay, here's the question that I immediately had, at least, and I don't know if you've had it as well, ridiculous historians. Did he survive long enough to use his blade arm in battle?
Well, one would think.
One would imagine.
Well, here's the thing, though. The speculation is like, he may have even used this to like eat, but I don't buy that. Why not have a fork arm if you're going to use it to eat? I mean, a blade arm is clearly designed to slice others.
And we know from the level of metalworking that was available at the time that they could make something
with tines or
they could make something that wasn't just a blade arm.
Mm-hmm.
They chose blade arm, and I'm not being completely prejudiced here, but I'm saying that choice implies some things.
Yeah, there's intention there.
It's the implication.
It's like Ash in The Evil Dead. He made himself a chainsaw arm.
Right.
You know, with which to slice demons, the undead. I mean, he didn't make himself, you know, some other non-lethal type of arm. Like a mannequin hand or
like a flagpole arm.
A flagpole arm, yeah.
You know, he didn't make anything like that.
He wasn't going to be a crossing guard. He was going to be a demon slayer.
And we know that with Knife Man, It appears that he did not, whatever he did with this blade arm, it appears that he didn't lift heavy weights with it. But surprise, surprise, that would be kind of difficult anyway, just to keep the prosthetic on.
Are you saying that his arm was slightly like atrophied or something?
No, we're saying that we can tell from the strain that, like, obviously his left hand, the one he still has, is going to be the new dominant hand, right? But
so it wasn't like as evenly distributed between the two.
Right. So we can tell that he wasn't attempting to or did not successfully for long periods of time lift heavy things.
But what about slashing?
Slashing's totally different because that's more of an impact, right, than a strain.
Well, I guess that's true.
So we would have to ask ourselves, they don't really address it in the paper, but we'd have to ask ourselves whether there's some sort of research we can do that would let us know whether he used it in combat.
You don't think if he did enough slashing and stabbing that he wouldn't have a big muscle on that arm?
Right, wouldn't you imagine?
I would think so. Yeah.
But then also, you know, we have to remember a lot of the stuff we're discovering with the prosthetic is based on guesswork because a lot of the leather has already decayed. This guy's been in the ground for a long time. I wish we knew his name, you know?
I'm fine with Knife Man.
You're fine with Knife Man?
He could be a boss in the Mega Man games.
He could. That's a good call. He probably also, knowing the way that nicknames and stuff worked at that time, he probably also had a name that was something like that. It was something like, you know, Gilbert Knife Hand or Gilbert of the Knife.
Mac the Knife.
Yeah, similar, right? Although Mac the Knife did not have a knife for a hand.
You don't know that.
Pretty sure.
It's not in the song.
It's not in the song, which they probably would have mentioned that, right?
You'd think.
You'd think, but this is our spooky tale for the week, and somewhat inspiring because, as we said at the beginning, it shows us that regardless of how a community might be portrayed in history,
love conquers all.
Love conquers all. It certainly heals. It heals wounds.
That's time.
That was probably a combination of both time and love.
Yeah,
and you have to marvel sometimes at just how tough these people were. You know what I mean? Like, I freak out if I have a cough for more than 2 weeks.
So do you have any prosthetic limbs that are lethal weapons of any kind? Write in, let us know. Send us pics. We're interested.
Oh, I thought you were asking me.
No, I know. I know you don't have any.
All right, man.
Wait a minute.
Let's keep moving. Yes. How can you find us? You can. We're so glad you asked. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We'd like to give a special shout out to everybody's favorite community page on the old FB. That is Ridiculous Historians, where you can shoot the breeze, see some pretty top tier memes, and give us suggestions for episodes you would like to hear in the future. As always, thanks to our super producers, especially to you, super producer Paul, for filling in today.
Yeah, thanks to Alex Williams, who composed this theme. Thanks to the one and only, irreplaceable, yet occasionally replaceable, super producer Casey Pegram, here in spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to our research peeps, Eves Jeffcoat and Christopher Hasiotis, who we love dearly. Mm-hmm. Just love those folks. They're the best.
He's a great guy. You know, he's a very talented food critic as well.
I do know that. And Eves is also on a show called Afropunk Solution Sessions, mm-hmm, and a show called Stuff Mom Never Told You. You should check those out.
Check them both out. We'd love to have Eves on the show one day soon, too.
Definitely.
So, spoiler alert with that. And you know what, Noel? Thanks to Knife Man for making it through the tough days and giving us an inspiring story. And thanks to you.
Just knifing around.